Well, I kind of like this. Everybody's sitting in a different spot. This, you know, you ought to try that each week. It'll confuse me. Well, last week we talked about what chair are you sitting in when it comes to your family, when it comes to being a follower of Jesus Christ, when it comes to us as a church, which chair are you sitting in? The chair of commitment, the chair of compromise, or the chair of conflict? The challenge, of course, was we need to all be sitting in the chair of commitment. If we're in the chair of conflict, in conflict with God, that will have a devastating effect in our lives and in our relationships. But even worse is sitting in the chair of compromise, where we say one thing, but we live another. That's the absolute worst chair to sit in, because it not only affects our personal lives in a devastating way, but we saw it is impossible to sit in the chair of compromise without it having a long-term devastating effect on our kids, the next generation, and on the church. We really can't gamble thinking that somehow we can say one thing and live another way without that causing our kids and those we have influence with to want to have nothing to do with God. The challenge for all of us is to sit in chair number one, the chair of commitment. But we ran out of time last week, so I couldn't explain something absolutely critical about that chair. If we think we just have to work harder, we just have to roll up our sleeves and really work at making sure we're sitting in chair number one, we are making a critical error. Because chair number one really isn't so much about what we do and our hard work, but it's about what we allow God to do in our lives before we even try to live out this life of commitment. Knowledge alone won't make it possible for you or me to sit in chair number one. Knowing the right things to do and wanting to do the right things is not enough to empower us to live this out. The Apostle Paul discovered this in his own life. When he wrote to the believers in Rome, he cracked open the door of his own life and let them see his own struggle. He was saying to them, man, I wanted to sit in chair number one. I knew that was the place to be. I knew that's where I would find contentment, the contentment I desired. And that's where I could find a purpose for my life. But no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't sit in and stay in chair number one. This is how Paul wrote it. I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do. But what I hate, I do. For what I do is not the good I want to do. No, the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing. What a wretched man I am. Paul knew all about the struggle of trying to sit in chair number one and then staying there by relying on himself and relying on his own strength and his own wisdom and his own willpower, only to fail and end up compromising. Finally, he cried out, who will rescue me from this body of death? And then he goes on in that letter to the Romans and explains how Jesus Christ, how the very Spirit of Christ did indeed rescue him and set him free. And he was not only able to sit in chair number one, but to stay there. And it all began when he allowed God to do this work in his heart and mind and life. It didn't happen by him trying harder to do it. It didn't happen because he was more educated than most. It didn't happen because he had a strong will that made it possible for him to resist even great temptation. It happened because he spent time with Jesus and allowed Jesus to work in him. You understand? That's the key for you and me. I want you to take your Bibles and turn over to the Gospel of John, the second chapter. We're going to read about some ordinary guys who, on an ordinary day, encountered Jesus, and they ended up being changed forever. And I think from the very first day, that very first encounter with Jesus, they began to understand what commitment really looked like. They began to understand what sitting in chair number one would mean for them. But before we even look at these ordinary men, let's pretend you're an angel. Now, I know that'll be a stretch for some of you. I know you have a good imagination, but not that good. But at least I'm not asking you to imagine that I'm an angel or your spouse is an angel or your kids are angels. So let's pretend you're an angel in the time right before Jesus starts his ministry. He's ready to leave the carpenter shop. He's ready to start this journey that's going to lead him to the cross. you receive a notice, you're an angel, you receive a notice that you've been given a special assignment, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You've been asked by God himself to serve on a special committee. You hate committees, but God has asked you, so you know this is an honor and a job must be important. Gabriel chairs this heavenly task force, and he begins by telling you and all the other assembled angels that your job, should you choose to accept it, is to determine who will announce the start of Jesus' ministry, what will be the first miracle that he will do, and how will he get the attention of the spiritual leaders of that day. Everyone decides that determining the first miracle will be the easiest, so that's where you start. Gabriel then tells all of you, this first miracle is crucial. It is the lead-off proclamation. It will be that which introduces people to the fact that Jesus is different and needs to be listened to. It must be carefully chosen. The angel sitting next to you, who is always quick to offer his opinion about everything, states the obvious. It must be powerful. Somebody else says, undeniable. It's important that it's undeniably from God and everyone knows it. And a third chimes in and says, I think it must be unforgettable. When it happens, it must impact people with such force that they will always remember where they were and what they were doing and who they were with when this miracle happened. And so Gabriel, knowing how committees like to talk and talk about everything, keeps the ball rolling by saying, we're all in agreement. The first miracle of Jesus on earth must have real clout. Any ideas? Any suggestions? And all the angelic creativity just begins to hum along. Someone says, let's start off with him raising someone from the dead. No, better yet, how about an entire cemetery? Let's have him just vacate the whole place. Someone else says, well, what if he fed every person one meal? Somebody said, nah, that's too easy. Besides, they'd forget the miracle the next time their stomach growled. How about if he removed all disease from the face of the earth? There are a few oohs and ahs at that suggestion. The other angels like that idea. But then you speak. You say, I know what it should be. All the other angels look at you and you continue. What if he rids the world of all evil? I mean, with one great swoop, all the bad is gone, and just the good remains. The group is sitting in stunned silence. Finally, one says, not bad. Another whispers, I like the idea. In fact, all the angels nod their head in agreement and tip their halos to you. And Gabriel says, it's settled then. The first miracle will be to wipe out all evil. Let's move on with our agenda. Who's going to announce the start of Jesus' ministry? And how will Jesus get the attention of the spiritual leaders? Now, hopefully, all of that sounds far-fetched to you because you've read John chapter 2 before and know that's not what happened at all. But there are, in this story, a couple of threads of truth. One is, Jesus had a very definite plan. You can tell that by some of the things he said while on earth. In John 2, chapter 4, he told his mother, my time has not yet come. And in John 7:6, he said, the right time for me has not yet come. And in John 12:23, he said, the time has come for the Son of Man to receive his glory. And over in Matthew 26, he said, the chosen time is near. And in the Gospel of Mark, he declared, the time has come for the Son of Man to be handed over to sinful man. And in John 17, when he was praying just before his arrest and crucifixion, it says, he looked towards heaven and prayed, Father, the time has come. You read all those words and you know, there's no doubt. There was a plan, a definite order of events. The mission and life of Christ was all planned out. Now, I really seriously doubt whether there was a committee of angels picking out the first miracle. But there was a definite plan. The second shred of truth from my scenario that came out of my nation of imagination, not only was there a plan, but there was someone who was to announce the start of Jesus' ministry. There was a first miracle, and Jesus did something to get the attention of the spiritual leaders of that day. Now, I don't think any of us would have chosen whom he chose to announce the start of his ministry. He chose a desert-dwelling, grasshopper-eating, smelling-like-a-camel guy named John. We would have all chosen someone with a little more class. At least someone who didn't eat the disgusting, and certainly someone that didn't smell like a camel. We would not have chosen whom he chose. And I'm pretty sure if we'd been choosing the first miracle, it wouldn't have been changing water into wine, just so a bride and groom wouldn't be embarrassed by their poor planning. And I'm also certain we wouldn't have chosen for Jesus to get noticed by the spiritual leaders by making them angry when he went into the temple and began to knock over tables and accuse them of turning God's house into a den of thieves. That's not what you want to do if you want to make a favorable impression on the religious leaders of your day. But I'm not really all that interested today anyway in who announced the start of Jesus' ministry and what Jesus' first miracle was, or even the reaction of the spiritual leaders. But I am interested in the sacred encounter Jesus had with some ordinary people and how it so impacted them that 3 years later, those same men turned their world upside down by telling and retelling the story of Jesus. In fact, they were willing to die instead of recant and say that they didn't believe that Jesus was God come in the flesh and that he was risen from the dead. And it's all because they chose to sit in the chair of commitment and stay there. And it all began with this encounter with Jesus. This group of fishermen, tax collectors, zealots, some married, some unmarried, young and older, and they finally found the answer to the question, what's the key to really living this life out? Knowing the right things is not good enough. Wanting to do the right things is not good enough. There's got to be another answer. And they found it in this relationship with Jesus Christ, and they gave themselves and eventually their lives to a purpose and a plan that was so much bigger than themselves. They discovered it when they no longer just accepted the status quo when it came to their religion, but they were ready. They were really ready to have their life characterized by a commitment that was so much greater than anything they'd ever been involved in. I want us to look at them and see what they caught by just spending some time with Jesus for a couple of days. I want us to see what they learned about God and about themselves and about how they should be living their lives, because this sacred encounter with Jesus had so changed them. And what it was that spurred them on to leave that place of complacency and compromise and move to that place of commitment. Never once in those first two chapters of the Gospel of John do you see Jesus setting these men down and saying, I'm going to teach you a lesson or two on who God is and what he expects of you. He never passed out an outline and say, okay, I'm going to preach this sermon and I want you to fill in the blanks. Letter A in your notes is. He didn't give them a theology lesson or anything like that. Basically, he just hung out with them, or they with him, and they began to catch what it meant to have a purpose and a plan for their life and be absolutely committed to it. It didn't come so much from what he said, but from what they saw and how he lived his life and the difference he then made in their lives. Understand, if we just put forth the effort to hang out with Jesus, so to speak, we really will be forever changed. If we give him access to every area of our life, what we do, what we think, how we react, every attitude, our understanding of what real commitment is will be changed. Now, in the first chapter of John, you read about Peter, Andrew, Philip, and Nathaniel being called to become followers or disciples of Jesus. A call to move to that chair of commitment. John the Baptist, the desert-dwelling, grasshopper-eating, smelling-like-a-camel guy, is the one who announced the start of Jesus' ministry. It's all there in that chapter. He points out at Jesus one day and says, verse 29, look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. So he's announcing Jesus' ministry. So these four guys start hanging out with Jesus. Every one of them, I think, was at a place where they'd been thinking to themselves, there's got to be more to life than this. I don't know if they were in conflict with God or if they'd begun to compromise, but they were absolutely, I think, complacent and were stagnant spiritually. So Jesus says, why don't you hang out with me for a while? And he doesn't pull out his pocket-sized Torah and say, the first thing I want you to do is memorize the Ten Commandments. And let me teach you a nifty song that will help you remember them. He didn't offer them a prize if they could remember the 39 books of their Bible or who could memorize the most verses from Psalm 119. He just said to them, why don't you hang out with me? And I want us to look at what they caught, what they learned about commitment by just hanging out with Jesus for a couple of days. Take your Bibles, if you haven't already. Turn over to that second chapter of John. Starting in verse 1 from the New Century Version of the Bible, it says, 2 days later, there was a wedding in the town of Canaan in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his followers were also invited to the wedding. When all the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, they have no more wine. Jesus answered, dear woman, why come to me? My time has not yet come. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you to do. In that place, there were 6 stone water jars that the Jews used in washing ceremony. Each jar held about 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. So they filled the jars to the top. Then he said to them, now take some out and give it to the master of the feast. So they took the water to the master. When he tasted it, the water that had become wine, he did not know where the wine had come from, but the servants who brought the water knew. The master of the wedding called the bridegroom and said, people always serve the best wine first. Later, after the guests have been drinking a while, they serve the cheaper wine. But you've saved the best wine till now. So in Canaan of Galilee, Jesus did his first miracle. There he showed his glory, and his followers believed in him. I want us to look at what these 4 ordinary guys, in particular, caught by simply hanging out with Jesus on an absolutely, utterly ordinary day. That's letter A in your notes, the ordinary. Understand, to be absolutely committed to God doesn't mean you have to become some kind of weirdo that no one wants to have anything to do with. The first lesson they caught had something to do with the kind of person they needed to be. I almost tripped over verse 2 when I read it this time. I don't know why I hadn't really noticed it before or thought about it, but this time it just sort of jumped out at me as I read it. It said, and Jesus and his followers were also invited to the wedding. You see, they learned something about the kind of person Jesus was and the kind of person they should be if they were going to be committed to being his followers from, number one, this invitation. Did you get it? Did you see it? When the bride and groom were putting their guest list together, Jesus' name was included. Whoever was hosting the party wanted Jesus to be there. Jesus wasn't invited because he was a celebrity, because at this point, he wasn't. The invitation wasn't motivated by his miracles. He hadn't performed any yet. There wasn't the hope of getting a great wedding present. He was an out-of-work carpenter. Why did they invite him? You know what I think? I think they liked him. I think that's a big deal. I think it's significant that the ordinary folk in this little town enjoyed being with Jesus. I think it's noteworthy that the Almighty didn't act high and mighty. The Holy One didn't have a holier-than-thou attitude. The one who knew all wasn't looked on as a know-it-all. I mean, people at this time later on would call him a blasphemer, but no one called him a braggart. They accused him of heresy, but never arrogance. He was branded a radical, but no one thought of him as being unapproachable. Some of his neighbors at one point thought he was a little crazy, but not once did one of those neighbors ever say to him, who died and made you God? I think people just flat out like Jesus. I think he went to the wedding to have fun. And I think the lesson was caught by these guys who were hanging out with Jesus and were invited to the wedding because they were Jesus' friends. And you know what? I think the more we hang out with Jesus, we're going to catch the idea that if we're going to be people of influence for him, we need to quit acting like we're better than others and how we wish they would just get their act together. We need to be likable. The second thing caught from Jesus was by seeing Jesus' intent. Just by hanging out with Jesus, they learn what matters and what is important to God. And now, Jesus didn't set them down and say, okay, here are God's top 5 priorities. Write them down, memorize them, and tomorrow I'm going to have a quiz on it. There was none of that. But they did catch what was important to God by what they saw. What did they see? Well, they saw when Jesus' mother came up to him and said, hey, these folks ran out of wine, they heard Jesus respond by saying, dear woman, why come to me? My time is not yet come. But then they saw him change his plan. They saw him change what he had intended. They saw the timing was changed, and he performed the miraculous. And in the process, they learned what matters to God is people, relationships, not our own way, not what we think is best, not simply what we want. What matters to God, what is the really big deal to God, is people. In that day and age, there was no bigger social embarrassment and social snafu than to run out of food or wine at a wedding. Weddings were week-long affairs. There would be several days of gift-giving and speech-making and food-eating. Hospitality at a wedding was considered a sacred duty. So serious were they about their wedding customs. If they weren't observed, if they ran out of food or wine, lawsuits could be brought by the injured parties. The bride and groom would be embarrassed. Their families would be embarrassed. They'd be the talk of the town and the butt of jokes. So Jesus changed his plans. He had said, my time has not yet come. But he changed the plan because what matters to God is people and relationships. You see, I think that's something we need to know about God and we need to understand about commitment. God is not great because there is nothing too big for him to handle. God is great because there's nothing too small for him. He cares about us. He cares about what's going on in our lives. And we should care about others in that same way. If we're sitting in the chair of commitment, more important than anything is those relationships, those people. And folks, the more we hang out with Jesus, and not just busyness, but the more we hang out with Jesus, the more we'll realize relationship is more important than winning the argument. Relationship is more important than getting our own way. Helping someone, even if it means rearranging our schedule, our plans, is more important than our own agenda and calendar. And then there's one more thing these guys caught by hanging out with Jesus, and that was the living illustration of what commitment to God looks like by what they saw in Mary, Jesus' mother, and how she handled the crisis. Now, admittedly, it wasn't a huge crisis. It wasn't big enough to make someone consider running away or taking their own life. It was one of those crises that fall under what I call the crud of life. It rocks the boat, but it's not life-threatening. Did you notice how Mary reacted in verse 3? She went to Jesus and said, they have no more wine. That's it. She didn't go ballistic. She simply assessed the problem and turned it over to Jesus. She could have exploded at someone. Why didn't you plan better? There's not enough wine. You never do anything right. I'm always having to clean up your messes after you've made them. Or she could have imploded. This is all my fault. I failed. I'm so stupid. I knew better. Why didn't I check the wine? Everybody would be better if I'm dead. It's so easy to focus on everything but the solution. But Mary didn't do that. She didn't point an accusing finger at anyone. She didn't beat herself up. She simply looked at the mess and took it to the one who could do something about it. And you also notice, she took the problem to Jesus, not to anyone else. And she didn't tell him what to do. And she didn't tell him how to fix it. She just took the problem to Jesus and left it with him. And I'm sure those four guys picked up on that. They were going to face all kinds of messes in the next few years. The crud of life would be filling every crack and crevice of their lives, and they needed to know how to handle it. And so without ever hearing a sermon on how to handle the crud of life, just because they were hanging out with Jesus on an ordinary day, they caught that lesson. Well, that was an ordinary day when they caught some pretty important lessons for life and what commitment looks like. They're still hanging out with Jesus a couple days later, but rather than it being an ordinary day, this next day became an unexpected, outrageous day. Let's look at that. Let it be in your notes, outrageous. Starting in verse 12 of chapter 2, it says, after this, Jesus went to the town of Capernaum with his mother, brothers, and followers. They stayed there for a few days. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover feast, Jesus went to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found people selling cattle and sheep and doves and saw others sitting at tables exchanging different kinds of money. Jesus made a whip of cords and forced all of them, both the sheep and the cattle, to leave the temple. He turned over the tables and scattered the money of those who were exchanging it. Then he said to those who were selling pigeons, "Take these things out of here. Don't make my Father's house a place of buying and selling." Let's be sure we understand why this was such an outrageous day. Remember these disciples, these four guys, they're rookies. All they've seen of Jesus at this point is one cool miracle. I think they watched, when they watched Jesus in the temple that day, they couldn't hardly believe it. I mean, they had just come from this great wedding party and everyone liked Jesus, and now it's Passover and everyone who was anyone was in Jerusalem. The streets are crowded. The temple is crowded. Jesus does something that draws attention to himself and to the disciples, and I think they were probably a little embarrassed by it all, by Jesus' action. They probably thought, this is bizarre. This is outrageous. What's going on? First of all, his actions were outrageous. Turning over all these tables, making a whip and driving the animals out, scattering the coins all over the place, and doing it in the temple. These rookie followers of Jesus had never seen this side of him before. They had never seen him annoyed, let alone red hot angry before. 3 years later, he's going to do the same thing. The other gospel writers tell us about that. And I don't think it bothered them that time, but this time was different. His actions were outrageous. Secondly, his assertion was outrageous. This out-of-work carpenter walks into the temple, tells the people to get out of his Father's house, and that's pretty outrageous. But then down in verse 19, he says, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." Let me tell you, it wasn't just the Jewish leaders who thought that was outrageous and said, "Hey, it's taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to do it in 3 days? Get real." But these rookie disciples were having the same thoughts. And this time, they didn't get any answers to their doubts and questions until 3 years later when Jesus was resurrected. In fact, in verse 22, John says, after he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said, talking about the temple being destroyed and then him raising it up. And then it says, then they believed the scriptures and the words of that Jesus had spoken. So evidently, this outrageous assertion Jesus made, destroy the temple and I'll raise it in 3 days, left lingering doubts for 3 years in the disciples' minds. And then number three, the third area that must have seemed outrageous to the disciples was Jesus' attitude. Now understand, Jesus is writing this John is writing this after the fact. After 3 years of being with Jesus and really getting to know him, and then 50 years of living with him and the Spirit of Christ actually being in him, that's why he would write verse 24 and 25. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them because they were asking for more miracles. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all men. He did not need man's testimony, for he knew what was in man. But when all this happened on that outrageous day, John and the other disciples weren't thinking that way. They were thinking, come on, Jesus, prove yourself. Prove yourself. Do another miracle. And they didn't understand Jesus' attitude. In fact, it seemed outrageous to them. Well, I want us to see what the disciples caught on that unexpected outrageous day. Let's look at the outcome. That's letter C in your notes. Number one, to be a person who is fully committed, you and I must be a person of character, not be a conformist. You and I must be people of integrity. Your beliefs must be the guiding force behind your actions, your assertions, and your attitude. You just can't conform to what others say it's okay, or because it's politically correct, or because you'd be better off financially. If Jesus was not a person of character, he would not have rocked the boat that day. You understand, you and I will always face challenges to compromise on the things of God. But if we allow our integrity to be the referee, it will resolve that inner turmoil and conflict. Lesson number two, to be a person who's fully committed, you and I must be a person of values, not vagueness. Jesus had a set of values that he lived by. Those values were established by the Word of God. The reason he reacted the way he did because of what was going on in the temple was because it violated his values. You understand, we, each one of us, must have a core set of values that we allow to guide us in every decision we make. Read Psalm 119 sometime this week. And it doesn't really matter which version you read it in. They all say the same thing over and over again. You got to follow the Word. The Word has to be it. You got to live by the Word. If you're ever going to find contentment or satisfaction and joy in life, you must be a person of the Word. You must live by the Word. Your core values will determine what you spend your money on, whether you keep going in debt, deeper and deeper into debt, whether you tithe or not. Your core values will determine whether you treat Sunday like any other day of the week, except maybe you go to church on that day. Your core values will determine what you do for entertainment and what you do to help others, the kind of relationships you're involved in. As you spend time with Jesus, you will come to understand there is no place for vagueness and compromise when it comes to the values we must allow to guide us in life. And then lesson number three the disciples caught on that outrageous day was to be a person who is fully committed. You and I must be people of credibility, not cleverness. Just by watching Jesus and saying how he didn't manipulate the crowd to get what he wanted, he didn't act in an outrageous way to become better known. He didn't do more miracles to get the people on his side. But he did what he did because it flowed out of who he was. His character, his values made him credible. This goes right back to making sure we're not saying one thing but living something else. Making sure we're not telling our kids and others we love Jesus but then living however we want. Remember, Jesus said, if you love me, you'll obey what I've commanded. In ancient China, the people wanted security and protection against what they thought were the barbaric nations of the north, so they built what has become known as the Great Wall of China. It's the only man-made structure astronauts could see from space when they look back on the Earth. So they built this Great Wall. It was so high they believed no one could climb over it. It was so thick they thought no one could knock it down. Its foundation was so deep they believed no one could tunnel under it. It was so long they believed no one would be able to go around it, and they settled back to enjoy their security. During the first 100 years of the Great Wall's existence, China was invaded 3 times. But not once did the barbaric nations break down the wall or climb over it or go around it or tunnel under it. Each time they did the very same thing. They bribed the gatekeeper and they just marched right through the gates. The Chinese were so busy relying on walls of stone to protect them, they forgot to teach their people to be people of character. They forgot to pass on a value system worth something. They forgot to teach people to be credible. And let me tell you, the greatest danger facing individual Christians and the church today is not Satan and his demons or the government and laws we don't like, and it's not the media presenting a different value system, and it's not politicians we disagree with. The greatest danger facing the church today are those who call themselves Christian. They come to church, they sing the songs, they're really nice people, but they're not people of character. They're not people of commitment. They don't have biblical values that they're holding on to. They're not credible. They sit in the chair of compromise. The disciples caught all these things, all these lessons, by just hanging out with Jesus on what was just an ordinary day, and then what turned out to be a couple days later, an outrageous day, and then by allowing Christ to transform them and the way they thought. So let me tell you, are you really spending time with Jesus? Do you need to first experience what Paul experienced when he was set free and was able to move into and stay in chair number one? Do you need to quit trying harder on your own and just allow the Spirit of Christ to set you free and transform you? That is the beginning place of commitment. First, allowing Christ to do a transforming work within you. This is what Paul urged the Romans to do. After he allowed Christ to do this work in his own life, he said, therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. And this is your spiritual act of worship. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You see, before you try to live out a life of commitment, before you try to move and stay in chair number one, before you try to even live the way Jesus would, you need to allow the very Spirit of Christ to transform you so that's even possible. Bow your heads with me.